Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. This is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, and it is November the 8th. We're into the thick of the month. Good day. So, how are you? So much talk about going on right now. Lots of activities on the Facebook page, Earth Ancients. This morning, I posted a new temple, an Egyptian temple that was discovered in the back garden of a palace in the Giza area, and they're estimating that the site's over 3,000 years old, and they've just begun to excavate it, and they have found not only the base of a number of columns of this temple, but limestone blocks with unusual hieroglyphs and statues and other fragments. And it was funny because the police caught him digging in this guy's backyard, and the trench that they were digging, I guess they had found some artifacts on the surface, and they were digging down to see what else they could find, was filling in with water, and the neighbors and the guy who owned the property actually called the police, and when they began excavating in seriousness and in full equipment, what they discovered was not only the foundations, but what looks to be a significant structure. So that was posted. I posted it a couple hours ago. The title is Ancient Egyptian Temple Discovered in the Back Garden, Sacred Stones Engraved with Hieroglyphics Unearthed in Giza. I imagine that there's so much left to discover there that this is the tip of the iceberg, but it's interesting to consider. The other bit of news, and it's been in the news quite a bit, Dr. Robert Schock reported on the Gunung Padang Pyramid in Indonesia, and Graham Hancock's been reporting on it quite a bit. But recently, they have discovered through imaging that there are a number of rooms in this pyramid. And this pyramid is quite large, and they've just scratched the surface. But what they found about a week ago, and Dr. Nina Danny is the... he's actually a geologist who has been empowered by the governor of Indonesia to actually carry out these excavations. They have discovered, or he has recently discovered, what looks to be some type of metal capacitor. And he uses the term capacitor because he believes it was used in some kind of electronics of some form. Now, it's pretty damning to call it a capacitor. Some have called it a metal device of some kind, but he calls it a capacitor because he believes, and some of the other people in his team believe, that it had some form of ability to run a current, an electric current. Now, I have, there's no pictures of this device. What I did post about a week ago is some metal that was found on the site. And by the way, it's Dr. Danny Hillman. It's not Dr. Danny. I said it's Dr. Danny Hillman, and he is the geologist who's in charge of this. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating. Robert Schoch has come back and revealed that the different levels of this pyramid, the deepest, I think it's the fifth level, is dated to approximately 20,000 years old. So this is a significant find, and we're waiting to see more about this so-called capacitor. But if you read a posting on the Facebook Earth Ancients page, it's an electrical device, and he calls it a capacitor, but it's being kept under lock and key while they're conducting analysis on it. It's a significant find. That whole area is a significant find, significant discovery, and I really urge you to keep an eye on what's going on there. It could really be some ground breaking discoveries. So it's quite interesting. My guest today is somebody I have been wanting to get on the show quite a bit. I actually was talking to him earlier in the program. Today's guest is Chris Dunn. And I was mentioning to him that I had had him at a conference at UC Berkeley in California. And it was 12 years ago, November 22nd, that he was our keynote at New Science Ancient Wisdom Conference, a conference I produced many, many years ago. And his work at that time was the Giza power plant, which was had just come out, and he was touring quite a bit. I was fascinated by it. I had a friend at the time it was Baring Company, which is now Inner Traditions and Baring Company, and I believe Chris was touring quite a bit then, and he came out and was, like I said, a keynote, and it was very, I mean, it was a groundbreaking talk. His research and his discoveries are referred to continuously, and I was just mentioning to him that at some point they're going to have to name a theory or a process after him, simply because everyone refers to Chris Dunn. And you know, if it's Ancient Aliens or the History Channel or it's a special TV program, there's even periods and points of reference to him where he's not even given credit. So I'm not sure how he feels about it, but I would think that he would wonder what's going on. So, Chris, are you there? Hi.
Hi, Cliff. Hi, Cliff. How are you?
I'm great. Great. Glad to have you on the program.
No, it's good to be here. Thanks.
No, I there's so much to talk to you about. I mean, you really broke open the whole understanding that we have now of what could be, we consider, modern tooling or modern machinery, cutting not only the structures at the Giza Pyramid, but in other locations around the world. But before I ask you that, let's talk about that. Let me just ask you this. Do you feel vindicated now that when you watch TV, people refer to your work? Do you think that's something that is you feel, you know, that you're satisfied with, that people are finally looking at these ancient structures with a different eye?
I think that is very satisfying to have so many people who are now saying the same thing, essentially. Certainly not everybody. I mean, you know, I have my detractors, just like anybody would. But people are looking at new artifacts or artifacts that have not been described before, and and recognizing the same kind of quality of craftsmanship on them and the same precision, and remarking that that they look like they were produced by a machine. Now, I must say that I wasn't the first to actually do that. The first person to describe the abilities of the ancient Egyptians and their the machines that they possibly used was William Flinders Petrie. In 1883, he has a book. He had published a book. It's called Pyramids and Temples of Giza. And in that book, he had a chapter on the methods, mechanical methods of the ancient Egyptians, and he described the tools that the evidence, the artifacts seem to indicate were used, such as circular saws, hole saws, or tree panning tools, things of that nature. And also the efficiency of them, the famous Petrie Core Number 7 that he puzzled over for a long time, and there was tremendous debate back in the 1880s about this Core Number 7, which is now housed in the Petrie Museum. And what is significant about that artifact is that it shows that the tool that produced it cut into granite at a feed rate of about 0.01 of an inch per revolution of the drill. And that made it got my attention. I mean, certainly that to any technician or tool maker, engineer, whatever they, or even a backyard kind of DIY guy who uses carpenter tools on a regular basis, they're like, wow, yeah, okay, I can see that something's going on here that has not been described properly by the tools that you find in the archaeological record. And so, of course, any engineer or technician will try and figure out what tools were used, and that's where you bump into a problem with the established conventional archaeologists and Egyptologists, is because they don't think along those lines. They limit themselves to the tools that are found in the archaeological record, and that's it. They're not allowed to imagine. I mean, and if they did, they wouldn't go as far as I did, which was to propose that they had very sophisticated tools and were using electricity and things of that nature. So, but now more people are traveling to Egypt. More people are traveling to South America. They're going to India, to Lebanon, to all these ancient sites. And whereas before, they did not, they were looking more at the magnificence of the sites and even and just considering the difficulty in assembling such large blocks, because you do have all over the world these megalithic, gigantic blocks of stone, which we don't, it's not our practice to get the heaviest block we can find to create a building, but they seem to be common in the ancient world, where they would use these multi-ton blocks, whereas we would cut them down into smaller elements and glue them together. But
well, let me ask you, was it apparent to you when you first went to Egypt that the temples and the buildings were cut with machines? Was it that apparent, or did you get caught up in the beauty and the splendor of these megalithic stone buildings and you had to come back a second time to be more appreciative?
Second time, third time, fourth time, fifth time. Yes, that's interesting, because I first went to Egypt in 86, but I started to research and write about Egypt in 1977. And interestingly enough, you had a guest on earlier, Dr. Arlen Andrews, And I met him in, I think, the tail end of 1977, and we've been friends ever since. And so he finally went to Egypt with me in 2008. We thought that we would see the new millennia in on top of the Great Pyramid, drinking a bottle of champagne, but that never happened. But in 2008, we went to Egypt together. But going back to that period of time, Arlen has always been extremely helpful to me and always very encouraging. And I was writing the Giza Power Plant. I just started writing it when we made contact. And so, you know, we had a lot to talk about because he had an interest in the pyramids. And I showed him some of the work that I was doing, and he was particularly taken by the analysis of what Petrie described in his book. And so I was actually at that time, I was having trouble finding a publisher or, you know, finding somebody to look at my manuscript. And he suggested, he said, well, you know, what I had read is that it's kind of like a catch-22, you know, you can't get your work published until you've been published. And so so basically you start out at the bottom. I approached Analog Magazine, and Alan was a frequent contributor to Analog Magazine. That's Analog Science Fiction Science Fact. And he said, well, you know, Chris, what you're better off to do is to get a section of your book which is as complete as possible. In other words, you know, it's a cohesive, coherent section where it doesn't run on to, you know, other areas of the book, or, you know, unless you would truncate that. But the best way to do that is to get a section and have it published in a magazine. And why don't you submit it to Stanley Schmidt, who is the editor of Analog Magazine in New York? So it was 1983 at the time where Stanley Schmidt accepted my proposal and recommended some changes. And I actually met Stanley in 1983 at the World Science Fiction Convention in Baltimore. Really nice guy, but I had just purchased a Commodore 64 computer.
You don't hear about those much anymore, that's for sure.
And so, you know, I was very fearful of how an editor might take the submission of a manuscript on a dot matrix printer where the G's stood above the line instead of hanging below. You know. And so I asked him I asked him if he would accept dot matrix, you know, because I was in the process of doing the revisions that he had suggested. And he said, yep, no problem there, you know, all for the
Good.
advance of technology. And so that was
He's a part of my
that's how I started. And the article was published in August of 1984. It did very well. It got quite a lot of attention, and it really sparked a lot of debate too.
Words.
And so that was, you know, my link with Arlen. And, you know, obviously after that, we became fast friends, and we used to live nearby, and then he moved away, and then I moved away, but we always remained friends. He's
Let me ask you
a
this.
brilliant engineer.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, it was great to have on our program. Yes. Let me ask you. This is something I've after reading your books. Do you have any reference points to the on the technology on the machining work that shows an evolution of the technology? In other words, did you find or have you found early works in stonemasonry or carving that has like an inception date when technology was used, all the way up to, say, the Ramsey II sculptures that you highlight in your book?
That's a very good question. The evolution of technology, the only thing I can refer to is the how technology has progressed today. And the progression of technology has been in the development of materials for cutting, the development of machines to refine machines so that they cut more precisely, and also computers. So when I started out, there were no CNC machines, no computer mm-hmm. guided machines at all, and that was in 1961. By the time I left the company I was working at, it was 1968, they had just brought in a computer numerical control driller. So all the advances in technology in manufacturing today, I mean, before that, you had development and you had improvements in technology, but the biggest improvement in the technologies has been in computer control and computer aided drafting and machining. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking at Cliff, if you're looking at the products that had come off a machine in 1960 or 1950 or 1960, say you take a lathe, for instance, and a good craftsman turns a shaft on a lathe, and you take that shaft and you put it side by side with a shaft that has been turned on a lathe today, except that the lathe is computer driven, and you take the machines away, you have no vision and no insight into what the machines were like that produced them, then they pretty much look the same. If they're held to the same quality, they have the same tool marks, because the rotational tool marks, and essentially they look the same. So when you look at a granite box in the Serapeum in Egypt, mm-hmm. and you see these perfectly flat surfaces, to within certain tolerances, of course. And then you look at the Ramses statue, where there is evidence of both, in my opinion, the machining of these heads, but also areas where there was some handwork performed. You can see evidence of both, and there are parallels in modern manufacturing too, where you would have machine work done and then some very fine detailing perhaps done by hand, just as a matter of economy. Mm-hmm. An example would be, you take a basic I-beam, which is produced automatically. You know, you've got these machines that pour the metal and they extrude the metal, roll these beams out. They come in certain lengths, certain sizes. They're shipped to a job site, or they're shipped to a metal working shop, and they are specialized or customized for whatever job that they go into, and then they may hit the job site and be further modified by the erectors at the job site. So those are the things that mm-hmm. happen all the time, and I'm glad you really brought this up, because it's a very important point to make, and mm-hmm. that is because when you look at an object and you say, yeah, this has the mark of machines, and it has this quality, this precision, these marks. There's always somebody who would like to dispel or debunk what you say by pointing out areas that where those conditions do not exist. So, in the engineering world and manufacturing world, or even the construction world, both conditions exist. And both states of manufacture exist. In other words, automatic, machine, and also handwork on site. And I think that's where you have to be able to distinguish what's the difference, you know, and how much pull from the piece in terms of the type of precision that is in it. And the only way to do that is to measure it. You have to get down and measure it. And I have received photographs from people. People send me photographs and say, has this been machined? I always tell them I can't tell by a photograph.
You have to be
I
there.
Never comment on that. I'd have to measure it in order to see how precise it is, because normally that reveals the quality of the methods used. And you find that I found it in Egypt, also in South America.
Let's talk about the Ramsey sculptures that you spend quite a bit of time discussing in the book. The level of precision in the faces and in the ear and in the nose and the mouth is you call it too perfect. It's too perfect to be hand done. To my mind, Chris, it seems to me that there was almost an industry dedicated to these sculptures because they're almost identical in so many ways. Would you say that's the case? That that was an actual industry around using this technology to create these megalithic sculptures with such a level of perfection?
I would say that yes, that definitely they had a protocol for creating them, and they also had a model, you know, whether that was a computer model or, but they were applying, they were working towards very precise data points in the crafting of these statues in order to reveal a geometry and precision that we see now as Ramses and also other ancient kings and pharaohs. So that is clear to me, is that they definitely had were using geometry in a way that has not been revealed before. In other words, it's very clear that they were familiar with the ellipse, and also that they knew what ellipsoids were. If you look at the crown of Ramses, the white crown, which is an elliptical shape, and it's like a conical shape that goes that's on the head, but it's kind of tilted back. That's a very complex, but it's complex, but it has a simplistic beauty to it. In other words, when you go to these crowns in the Luxor Museum, and the first time I saw them, I was blown away because I was running my hand over the surface, and it was perfect, perfectly smooth. There's no ripples, no bumps, but I didn't know what the geometry of them was, and so I was first taken by the crowns because they were, you know, very accessible to examine. And that
right.
was actually in February of 2006, and I had I'd signed up to go with John Anthony West on his tour as a paying guest. And you know, because I wanted to learn more about Shwela de Lubick's. And,
right.
you know, as my as my life has progressed, that is what happened is fairly common. I go with the focus of intentions of focusing on one thing, and then something else gets my attention. And so after being in the temple for a period of time listening to John, I couldn't resist wandering away from the group and examining these crowns, and then after that time I went back the following day and photographed them. I had a new digital camera. Back then it was an 8 megapixel, which is pretty low res these days. But but anyway, and I also had my computer with me, so I was able to bring them into my graphics program and examine them in a way that checked the symmetry. Is one side the same as the other side when you're looking at it 2D? And it was incredibly precise, certainly totally unexpected, and you know, even that in itself speaks to a culture that had advanced far more than Egyptologists have given them credit for in terms of their abilities to create these shapes and what they used in order to do them.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the Ramses sculptures, because they're featured in your book, but are any two so similar that they look like they could have been molded? I mean, it looks to me, based on your analysis, is that these are they're carved from some either machine template or some, as you call it, model. Which, to my mind, means that it was a pre-programmed, for lack of a better word, software that was digested by a machine, and it was maybe a block of stone was put into some kind of a chamber or something, and then it was cut. Or do you think it was more? Do you hypothesize that it was maybe done by individuals, where one guy would start with the top, another guy would come in and do the face, another guy would do the arms or whatever? Can you take it that far?
I think there is, I've been raised in an environment where there is a division of labor. So you have people who will do rough machining. You have your people who quarry, the people who haul the materials, and then it comes into a manufacturing plant. You have roughers and finishers, you would have a situation where you'd have several classes of people working on the object. And then you may have, some fine details at the end, because you can actually see on the face under a microscope, if you look very, very, very closely, the tool marks, there's definitely tool marks there. Well, as you have read the chapters in my book, you know that, but because I show them very clearly. And so, but it looks like, particularly around the eyes, it looks like a hand tool has been brought in after the face was machined, just to create a sharp intersection between where the eyelids are and the eyeballs and the face, and similarly on the mouth, where the vermilion border of the lips, they are undercut slightly and made a little sharper by the introduction of a tool to create a more defined outline of the lips. And so that's where you have a perfect example of something being made, the most important aspect, the most important feature on the Ramses statue is the face and what that represents, and the nose. But the real care and precision has to be in the geometry of the face, and it's where you look at a mirror image of the face, and you overlay that mirror image, and you can see the perfection from side to side. You've got this symmetry from side to side. And when you consider take the jawline, for instance. You know, the jawline is moving in 3D. Three dimensions, you've got your X, Y, Z. So it's not just a simple two-dimensional profile that we're looking at. But when you look at it in two dimensions, you're looking at a perfect circle or a radius that is the same from one side to the other. So that is definitely a very telling and good evidence of machining. Not to say that people have not been attempting this kind of work in terms of symmetry with just hand tools or using templates and things of that nature, or manual templates. Mm-hmm. But the precision, as we look at the Ramses, is three-dimensional. It's not two-dimensional. And so that is significant to me. And then, of course, the elements that go into making it. The geometry was very, very faithfully executed. And the geometry indicates that, you know, they had a certain geometric protocol and measurement that they were using. And there is a certain harmony, you know, the harmonic proportions of this geometry and the correspondences with the 3-4-5 triangle grid You know, everything is radial or circular. And so what you have is a very, very pleasing face. And there are other unique features on the face, too, such as the eyes. The eyes, when you look at the profile, the eyes are looking down. What has been built into the statue is a visual compensation, so that when somebody who is looking up at the statue, they will see a face that is smiling, rather than the mouth turned down, because Ramses' mouth is a significant feature too, because it has a full radius to it. From one side of the lips to the other, and it's hard to find anybody who walks around that way naturally. But if you certainly not this old part, that's for sure. but if you want to present a pleasing image to people who are standing below, and you make the lips look natural, then when they are viewed from below, it looks like the mouth would be turned upside down. You know, they would have a frown more than a smile on their face. But you know, that's just another feature that is the statues are incredible. I mean, the detail is amazing, what they were doing. Just the attachment of the elbows with the thighs, that was done, and you know, it's for strength. It gives the statue strength instead of having arms that are free, or you have a gap between the forearm and the thigh, for sure. Anybody sitting naturally would have that, but the statues, they they took down the elbow so that the forearm would be attached to the thigh and provide the statue strength. And
if,
then the
if
beard,
Ramses,
the beard. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was just
okay,
going to
well,
ask you.
The other thing is the engineering and manufacturing strength is the headdress, which is attached to the shoulders, and the false beard attached to the chest. So mm-hmm. those serve as gussets and provide strength to the head. Whereas if the head was loose, you know, or if it was just mm-hmm. Without the headdress, then it would be a lot weaker.
Okay. Ramses the second lived, what, is it like 5,000 years ago? Is that the rough estimate for him? When these sculptures would have been...
No, they're...
What is the estimated date
on
those?
I'm embarrassed to say I don't have the fixed date in front of me on that.
Okay.
But I know it. They're a lot newer. They come later than the pyramids for sure. So they may be Middle Kingdom or Late Kingdom, but not not 5,000. Not even well.
Not 5,000.
Dates. The dates are to me. You could say 5,000, 10,000. I think what has happened is that they've been misappropriated and assigned to Ramses. I don't think these statues belong to the that period at all, because the you know, the quality of the manufacturing goes way further back than that, and it's kind of similar to the pyramids and the boxes in the Serapeum that have all this tremendous precision, and also similarities in the tools, or at least the shape of the tools that would have created them, mm-hmm. in that they share common features like the radius in the corners of these objects, and a lot of them have the same radius. But there you're looking at 4th dynasty to 18th dynasty, and the Serapeum is 1,000 years BC, something like that. And you know, as far as Ramses, I couldn't give you an exact date on that. I'm not an Egyptologist.
You found other examples since the book came out, Chris? Have you found any similar examples of this of the Ramses II machining technology on anything else, any other sculptures that are effigies of a king or queen?
Well, I think when you find something of this nature, then you have, you know, you begin to recognize the same qualities in other statues too. What I have to be careful with though is that I've devoted most of my time just focusing on the Ramses, and while other statues may have the appearance of that same quality, I have not done the examination of them that I did with the Ramses statue. But mm-hmm. I would say that they are, you know, they're open to be examined too. There are some remarkable examples in the British Museum in London, where, you know, some really beautiful, beautiful busts, and even a Ramses statue there too. But they're some marvelous examples of what I would consider to be machined statues.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. In the Giza power plant, you speculate and give evidence that the pyramid was created as a generator, energy generator.
Mm-hmm.
That book is over a decade old. Do you still feel that it was a generator, and how Do you find or feel that generated energy was delivered to other parts of the plateau?
Yeah, the I haven't backed off of that theory. In the book, I said that it's open to challenge, it's open to review, and if other evidence was to show up or was to turn up that would cause me to rethink the theory, then I would, you know, accept what new information came along, good solid information, and revise or reject my original theory. And that's the way science works. While there has been, you know, challenges to it and arguments against it, the evidence that I present has never been a part of that so-called challenge. And so what I have maintained is that, you know, anybody who would want to replace the power plant theory with a better theory needs to have a reason, or, you know, you need to be able to explain every piece of evidence that is in the Great Pyramid, in terms of, you know, what it was used for. And as time has progressed, the new evidence that I've turned up, and also others have turned up, have reinforced the theory rather than dispel it. And
okay.
One of those is the scorch marks on the ceiling of the Grand Gallery, which was predictable in the Giza power plant, when you consider that it proposed that there was an explosion inside the Great Pyramid in the King's Chambers, and so that would explain the scorch marks in the Grand Gallery. And, you know, I proposed that the Grand Gallery housed these resonators, and the resonators were placed and assembled in the slots along the ramps of the on both sides of the gallery. And and then, you know, when you look at these slots and you look at the ceiling above and you see these scorch marks, it's apparent that there was a fire going, you know, that whatever the, when the explosion happened, it caused a lot of destruction of the equipment in the Grand Gallery. That there's that. Then there is the Gantenbrink's door, and for, you know, somebody who wants to review this further, I have several articles on my website. And the website is gizapower.com. there's a lot of articles on the on Gantenbrink's door and the evidence leading to it, what was behind it, and beyond Gantenbrink's door. And then there was some recent activity there where they discovered this writing on the floor behind in the space at beyond Gantenbrink's door.
Do you think it was electricity that was produced in the Giza pyramid, or was it another form of energy that was converted to electricity? Because you did say that you felt that the machinery on the carvings of that were used for the carvings were as electricity. You use that term, but maybe it was some other energy?
Well, the electromagnetic energy, that's electricity. So I propose that the evidence seemed to suggest to me that they were generating microwaves, microwave energy. And the reason I suggested that was that the shafts coming into the King's Chamber on the north side, there the shaft coming into the north side of the King's Chamber was, the dimensions were 8.4 by 4.8, and that would be suitable for a hydrogen microwave. And then opposite that shaft on the other side, on the in the south wall, is what appears to be, what looks like a horn antenna, a microwave horn antenna. So it's like a catcher's mitt there, cut into the granite, where and then a shaft leading from that to the outside. So that was a part. That was one of the reasons I actually proposed that they were creating microwave energy, converting hydrogen gas into microwave.
Okay, and then so how do you speculate that energy was delivered to the machinists who used their tools to cut sculptures and blocks and things like that?
Well, I would say that you could deliver it wirelessly, or you could deliver it over wires. I mean, it depends on what methods they choose. I mean, if you have a source of energy and you know about electricity, then you use whatever state-of-the-art equipment or technology that you're aware of at the time.
I thought you, when you said microwave, I thought for a minute, okay, well, that's wireless. They're shooting out microwaves, and then they have a receiver somewhere that maybe downsteps it or whatever, and then it's channeled into a device, and then then they have their cutting and machining tools. And that, is that what you're speculating? That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, that's a scenario that I could imagine.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. It could have been something else, but definitely that would be one way to do it.
It's so mind blowing to consider that. You know, I mean, like that's kind of like beyond us today. It's so far. We kind of parallel that with our cell phones and things like that, and microwave ovens, but.
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. We're kind of the technological environment that we live in is the result of a rather haphazard development of different technologies to deliver services and to make people money. And it's like the battle between Edison and Tesla, and between AC and DC, and then associated with that is the how fraught with uncertainty that kind of process is, because a lot of times it depends on the people who are holding the purse strings. Well, always it depends on who's holding the purse strings. So, what their agenda is, and one thing and another. But ultimately, our society has developed, and we have using these technologies. But it could have gone a different way. Who knows? It's like, was Tesla in his proposals to energize the world wirelessly and freely? Would his ideas have worked if he'd have received the backing and the funding to do it? A lot of Tesla supporters think, that it could have done that. But we don't know, because it hasn't received the funding for full-scale development. It didn't when he was alive. And then it kind of faded away after he died. So, but it's kind of like when I wrote the Giza power plant, I just put the information out there. I didn't know what kind of legs it would grow, whether it would die on the vine, or whether it would, you know, it would continue to be red. And well, for at least 14 years, it's 16 years. 16 years now that it's been published, and so it's, you know, and then, you know, that is a small period of time compared to the age of the pyramids, but 16 years later, and, you know, books are very important, I think. When you look at Petrie's book, he wrote his 100 years ago, you know, and then I picked it up 100 years later, and we start talking about Petrie's work again.
Yeah. So I mean, Petrie was an Egyptologist. Why is there so much resistance to your discoveries and your basic clarification on the machining of these artifacts?
Well, people are very resistant to new ideas, even if the ideas sound relatively sane. And I think that if an idea somebody in academia as an Egyptologist would consider my ideas to be insane, and so not worthy of even discussing. So, you know, that's what we're faced with. What would make that turn is a greater acceptance of, you know, recognition of the technical abilities in machining, which is why I work very hard and long to gather as much evidence to support the machining aspects and abilities of the ancient Egyptians, because that to me is a kind of a easier, I think it can be accepted a lot easier by people who would normally be against the idea of lost civilizations, highly technical lost civilizations.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's kind of like eventually they're going to have to be able to explain how these mankind cannot continue to ignore the evidence cut into the stones of these ancient sites. They have so far, they've been able to maintain the status quo in our education system, but I threw out a challenge in the lost technologies of ancient Egypt, and that is that we don't, you know, if we find evidence in the archaeological record of tools that were used, or that we claim that they were used in ancient times, then what we need to do to prove it is to replicate the most difficult things that the ancient Egyptians did. Not the simplest thing, not to, you know, just take a piece of copper and apply some sand on the surface of granite and grind a slot in the granite.
Yeah.
Anybody can do that, and then say, "See, we know that we can. We know that you can remove granite using copper and sand." Okay. Now, how do you explain this? Because you have to. You have to be able to reproduce a Ramses statue, in my opinion, and a Serapeum, a box in the Serapeum. If you're going to hold to those ideas that these simple tools built the ancient world, then you have to prove it. Because, we're...
That's a good point.
It's experimental archaeology and science. It's science, you know. You don't write a good paper that about cold fusion, and say, I found this and I found this and I found this, and so I put everything together. You put everything together in my mind, and you've got cold fusion. I mean, that's essentially, that you're going to say, okay, great. Now show me, prove it. And that's what we need to do more with Egyptologists, I feel, who are still stuck in the past in terms of, you know, the tools that were used.
Yeah, we've had a couple of young Egyptologists on the program, and they're fighting against the system, but it's a little bit of an uphill battle because the discipline is steeped in the history of these false understandings, and so it's tough. It's a tough hill to climb. We only have a few minutes left, and I want to go over some of your findings in South America. You traveled to Bolivia and Peru, and I have read a couple of articles, one specifically on some of the research you did at Pumapuco, where you actually brought some engineering tools and to do some analysis of some of the buildings. I've never been there, but there's some people speculate that those are poured reinforced walls and blocks, some form of cement. What did you discover there?
They were very precise features on the blocks, and I measured some of them with an indicator gauge and surface gauge, and a flat surface within a 0.005 of an inch around a 360-degree arc. That makes me sit up and gets my attention. When you look at the blocks themselves, they're natural stone. You can talk to Robert Schacht. He's been there many times. He will tell you it's natural stone. If you are prone to consider the poured stone theory, then there are, you have to explain some very, very difficult technical details. In other words, what you have on a lot of these blocks are cavities that have negative drafts in them. And so if you've got a mold and you're setting any kind of material and you have a negative draft, you're not going to be able to release your mold. And then the other thing is, a lot of times you would have, if you are creating blocks that are the same, they have the same appearance, same features, you would use a mold. It's the same mold to create many blocks. I mean, that is the whole reason for forging and casting is that you create the shape one time and then you use it multiple times by pouring metal or whatever material you have into the molds. And with that process, you would find that the measurements from one block to the next do not vary that much. And so in 2011, when I went to Pumapunku, I took some inside micrometers, and also I took the some verniers. The inside micrometers were large enough. I could span 36 inches with them. But I also had surface gauges and indicators. And so I was able to check the dimensions on the H blocks, the famous H blocks. And they were not the same. I mean, the dimensions were different. I think I had an article. I published an article in Atlantis Rising. It was in January, early this year, of my visit to Pumapunku and discussing the H blocks and other blocks that have these very fine features on them. Grooves. There's one block that has a groove down the length of it and holes drilled into the groove. So I was able to measure the distance from the groove to the corner of the the adjacent surface, and I and that, and also the distance between the holes, and the distance from the face to the edge of the groove was quite precise, but the distance between the holes that were fairly random. They were not precise at all. They varied quite a bit. And unfortunately, my tables, the tables I supplied to accompany the article, were not published. And but that's where, you know, for me, a guy like me, the devil's always in the details. But I think for the average reader, you know, they just like a good story. So, but it was a good story.
I think you're right. were there definitive machining marks on any of those H squares or any of the foundation that it's all looks like some kind of earthquake went through there and kind of shuffled it all around? But did you determine that there were some markings that would reveal the tool mark of some kind of big powered machinery?
I wish I could say yes, Cliff, but I that's the real puzzle about it. And it could be that I just hadn't got, I just hadn't examined it in the right way. I mean, there's, I didn't use a microscope on the surface of the stone. That would probably help. As far as conventional kind of tool marks that one would expect if you were using a grinding machine or a milling machine or something like that, there didn't seem to be anything. You know, there were no regular swirling patterns that you know, are associated with those kind of processes
that I
could detect. You know, somebody else may have a better luck than me, but like I said, I think we were talking earlier, When you're on a tour with a tour group, I generally focus all my time, try to spend my time with the guests, and and to do the kind of research that I do, I have to go back later and spend more time and take better equipment with me. That happened in Egypt, and that will happen in South America ultimately.
Gotcha. You know, Go ahead. I was going to say, in the few minutes we have left, you have studied what I call anomalous machining for over 20 years, 25 probably, over 25 years. Have you come to some conclusion on the world during the time these things were created? I mean, is it a loft? I mean, some authors call it a civilization X that left traces of their advanced machining, the advanced technology. Do you think it's, and then if you study the Vedas, the Yugas, the Hindu history of the world, it goes, you know, according to them, that goes back hundreds of thousands of years, which would give rise to multiple civilizations who could develop sophisticated technologies, and then through self-termination or a global catastrophe of some nature, were wiped off the planet. But I'm interested to learn what your feeling is as to the progenitor. It's so easy to just fall down and say, well, it was Atlantis. Atlantis. Right. I mean,
yeah.
Where it could be, a world we just don't know about that had an inception period, developed their own technology, developed their own engineering, and then just vanished. I'm just curious about what your opinion is.
I mean, it's obvious to me, and that the evidence points to a worldwide civilization, or at least what we have experienced in our history is that these technologies may develop in one part of the world and then be exported to another part of the world, but it doesn't end up in every corner of the world. In other words, you know, the manufacturing of airplanes generally grew in North America, and then, you know, the Boeing became the heavy hitter in terms of eliminating the competition, or at least reducing their footprint in the industry. But now you have, you know, the Europeans with their Airbus and the, you know, their introduction of those airplanes, which, you know, very sophisticated machines. But there is no other country that builds them to that scale. They have some commuter jets being developed in Japan, in Brazil. They have them in Brazil. They actually build them there. But, you know, there are other areas that are attempting to enter into that market and develop their own. But right now, as it stands, we find that technology on two continents, pretty much. And the same as you, if you look into prehistory, you have the Egyptian technology, which is evident. And then if you go to South America, I find South America more of a challenge than Egypt in a way, because the way they built their structures is unbelievable. It's quite remarkable, and how they did. I mean, the wall at Sacsayhuaman, and you know, the 12 faces on a block with other blocks coming in and fitting them perfectly. And these are huge multi-ton blocks, and you know, and you look at the there's no geometric protocol that is immediately obvious that would indicate that they were created by a machine, because what we know about machines is machines move in linear axes, and there's no flat surfaces at Sacsayhuaman. You know, they're very random, very random contours on the surfaces, but they all fit together beautifully. That's a real mystery to me. And, you know, the other sites are a real mystery. I mean, the Machu Picchu is very beautiful, but there isn't as much what I consider to be advanced kind of... I don't, you know, there's no signs of machining that I could point to at Machu Picchu. They have some impressive, you know, an impressive temple where the very large blocks are used. But as far as the quality of the work, you have to go to Bolivia and to Pumapunku to find work that one could say, yeah, I can pretty much conclude that they were creating these using some kind of machines. Now, how the tools were guided, how they were powered, that is another matter. But the geometry and the precision is the smoking gun, just like in Egypt.
Interesting.
But as far as ancient culture, worldwide culture, I think I'm not sure about the communication from one to the other. It seems that they did have some, they did find cocaine or nicotine in some old mummies in Egypt that would have come from the New World, the South America. But other than that, I think my friend Stephen Mailer, he has noted some similarities between the patterns in a temple in Egypt and the Mayan symbols. So that's, you know, there you could there has been some kind of sharing of information over the continents, I think. Atlantis, you know, we have a civilization that I believe had, whether it was called Atlantis or something else, but it was a highly advanced. When you consider the what they left behind, you have to envision what the infrastructure was to create it, and then what other kind of technologies and abilities that they had in that particular civilization.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
A turn of the spade.
Exactly. What can we expect from you in the near future, Chris? Are you do you have a book in the works? What's on the horizon for you that we can look forward to?
Well, I wouldn't tell anybody not to hold their breath. I'm notoriously slow at getting new books out. The yes.
Okay. Good.
I've written two books, and the first one was, you know, it was, that was, I didn't know if I would write another one after that. I just had this, these ideas in my head, and I just wrote about them, and that kind of, opened up a whole different focus for me, coming from a background of manufacturing, and that was focusing on just the machining and the manufacturing abilities of the ancients. Because as you pointed out, there has been a huge interest in that particular aspect, that particular. And then other engineers have come along, and technicians, and they are seeing the same and reporting the same. And in fact, there was a documentaries that recently aired on the History Channel called Ancient Impossible. And I think that was the episodes that my friend Arlen was he became rather incensed because they had taken my work and presented my work, but they did not give me any credit. I could have appeared in that documentary if my home circumstances had been different. But they weren't, and I didn't, and I passed up that opportunity. But they did use my book, and I did refer them to an engineer in England who was following my work, Peter Brooks, and he is currently in Egypt, following my footsteps, and he's a retired aerospace engineer. And so, you know, to have other engineers, retired or otherwise, taking an interest and getting out there and following, that's basically all I can ask for, you know. The credit goes to the ancient civilizations, the people that created these things.
Your book is a super reference, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, Advanced Engineering in the Temples of the Pharaohs, I have a copy of it right in front of me. It still holds its weight, and I don't think there's any disproving. I think it's a solid piece of work, and I do hope you continue, Chris, and I think we all do who are a part of our audience here to keep at it, because without your contributions, I think we're in the dark on what the ancients were up to.
Well, I wouldn't say that quite. I mean, I think we're all a little bit in the dark, but I've been privileged and blessed to have been supported by some incredible people on my path. And And so, you know, I don't take all the credit. I've been guided and helped along the way in many different ways, and it's been a real blessing for me, that's for sure. The
Well,
as far as my
yeah.
next work, I was going to go to South America and do that research that I had hoped I would do, but I'm not sure about that right now. Something is calling me back to Egypt, and I've also been asked to provide updated information on the Giza power plant, and there's also the possibility and opportunity to do more research and some more experiments with that. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much my what lies in my future. That and retirement.
Fantastic. Well, it's been a real pleasure having you on the program, Chris Dunn, and best to you, and we'll look forward to reading more about your discoveries.
Well, thank you, Cliff. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Right. Thanks again. So that was Chris Dunn, and I really strongly advise you to get his book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. It's put out by Inner Traditions, and it is the number one book on ancient machining in Egypt. Until next time, I hope you have a great week. Keep an eye on Facebook, Earth Ancients, Starley New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. Have a great day.